And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a very, very gifted writer, and you may know his name, Greg Iles. He is from the Deep South, originally from Natchez, Mississippi, or he has spent most of his life there. And as a matter of fact, some of his best-selling fiction has been set in Natchez, Mississippi, primarily a trilogy. And now he has, in a sense, returned to Natchez, Mississippi with his latest novel, which is called Southern Man. And this is a book that is actually about much more than Natchez, Mississippi and the surrounding area. It is a book that is, in a sense, a political thriller, and it sets in motion events that threaten to tear our country apart in a way not seen in more than a century. And it is a disastrous split along racial lines. And there is the terrifying possibility of parties who are actually encouraging some of this in order to capitalize on it for their own gain. It is a novel in which friendships and families are split, and where all kinds of things are called into question, including whether or not our country can even survive such tumult. And it is written in a way that is just so bracing, so vivid. And one can easily imagine such things happening, in part because this novel is essentially set in the immediate present day. And we see many familiar names that that populate the world that Greg Iles has created. And his central character of Penn Cage remains as compelling as ever. And it's a novel that's absolutely amazing from start to finish. It's published by William Morrow. And again, it's titled Southern Man, the latest novel by best-selling author Greg Iles. Greg Iles, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here, man.
Glad to be making your acquaintance. Your reputation precedes you as a really gifted and prolific writer. And one of the things I wanted to be sure to do, since this is the first time we're chatting, is to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your really interesting life, because your own life in many respects is reflected certainly in this novel, and I suspect in some of your previous novels as well. First of all, for somebody who lives in the heart of the Deep South, it's interesting to read that you were actually not born in America at all. Tell us about being born in West Germany, and to whatever extent you think any of that has sort of carryover effect in the way you see the country that, of course, is your home and the setting of your fiction.
Well, that's that's a good question. I think it does, actually. I was born in 1960, and like a lot of people in my generation, my dad was in the military at that time. He was a military doctor. He and my mother had both come from the Deep South in Louisiana. And the importance of that, I think, the relevance of that to the books and to my life is that they happened to be in Germany at the time that Germany was going through its own reckoning about what had happened during the World War II years and the Holocaust. They became, they had been raised as Christians, but they became very familiar with the Jewish experience in Germany, of course, in that period. And so when they returned to the South, when I was still very young, 3 years old, they had an insight that most of their neighbors did not. So that when the civil rights movement and troubles started to happen in the 60s in Natchez, they immediately drew parallels with their knowledge from what they had seen in Germany and what they knew about. And so instead of having the standard issue prejudices that a lot of parents had, or me having them as a boy, I sort of had a different insight from the beginning. Now, again, I got to the South from the age of three. And so I consider myself about as native a Southerner as you could ever be. And as I pointed out in this book, it's amazing now that we live in the 2020s, I went back. My mother had passed away, so I dealt with her in this book to look back at her life and realize things like she had started picking cotton from the age of three and things like that. Those things are just unimaginable now, you know, in the world we live in. And so I just, as you know, this is a big book and I really explored everything. So I'm going to leave the questions open to you. But if for those who are interested in the South and curious, this is certainly the book for them, I think.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why I found it so interesting. I'm very much a northerner. The farthest south I've lived is Atlantic, Iowa. So,
oh my God.
So for me, and I don't know that I've ever set foot in the state of Mississippi, for instance. And so I felt like I was learning a lot about a part of the country that is quite exotic. On the other hand, something that you and I share in common is that I also was born in 1960.
And really? So
I am of an age where I have a certain memory of the civil rights movement as
sure.
it began to take on sort of extra urgency in the 1960s and into the early 1970s. And of course, the way that was playing out in Northeast Iowa was very different, I'm sure, from the way it was playing out in the Deep South. But I think it's interesting to think about being a youngster and having events portrayed on the news and overhearing your parents and others talking about things and maybe not fully understanding just exactly what's going on and why. I suspect for you as well,
yes,
maybe that's part of your own life experience.
Well, and in the South, you know, the first book where I really started to deal with Mississippi in this way was my fourth novel, and I titled it The Quiet Game. And there's a reason I did that, and it's because probably you growing up where you did hear reports of the kind of violence and things that were going on, not just in the South, but around the country. Whereas in the South, those things did not generally make the papers. They did not make the television news. They would be on the national news. But there were many local murders, local violence that never, of course, made the national news. And that started to be the basis for my trilogy years later, you know, really about, I guess, 15 years ago. It's interesting, too. For me, the years 69-70 in Mississippi were the years that they really pushed to integrate the schools. I'm curious where you grew up. Where did you know, do you remember the point at which it became, you know, fully integrated in terms of education?
Well, of course, where I grew up, a small town in Iowa, there was, in a sense, nothing to integrate.
Right, right.
So it again, it's so interesting to think about so much of one's perception depends on where you grew up and the landscape within which, for instance, you're being sure. educated and interacting.
Yeah, the population where I grew up, of course, was 50% Black from the time I was a kid. That's a thing. It's with the name of this book being Southern Man, and it evokes Neil Young's song and the sort of purported feud between Neil Young and Lynyrd Skynyrd and those kind of things. It's funny when you had Yankees or Canadians preaching about race to Southerners, and of course, they'd hardly ever seen a Black person their whole life. they had no idea what they were talking about. And I'm not defending the Southern position at all, but I'm just saying it's easy to preach when you know nothing, you know?
Right, exactly. I want to circle back to the South in a moment, but I want to ask you about a couple of other aspects of your life in terms of what I have read.
Sure.
One of them is the fact that you were in a very, very serious car accident some years ago, more than a decade ago, and you ended up losing part of one leg. And it's certainly no coincidence, I'm sure, that the main character in Southern Man, Penn Cage, has also is missing part of a leg. And another main character is actually missing part of one arm.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel for me. It was anyway.
Right.
Penn has always been a partial reflection of me, certainly as a character reflecting his author. He's never been completely me, but he's always been partly me. And with this book, I did something few series writers ever do. If you'll notice with popular series, guys tend to leave their protagonist eternally the same age. You know, it's bizarre. Even if their character was like fought in Vietnam or something, he may run the series 20 years and he's still talking about what went on in Vietnam. And I'm thinking, this guy's got to be 75 now, you know? So anyway, what I did in this book was, because it was going to deal so honestly with what's going on in this election year and in the present, I literally leapt ahead 15 years in the series and I aged my character. And that's certainly a risk. And then I just went ahead the whole way and let him be that much more like me. Because as you know, and it may come up today, not only did I lose my leg and then have my aorta torn in that accident, but of course, now I'm also battling a very serious cancer as well. And I just found it over the course of 4 years of writing this novel, impossible really to write it with the character so close to me, but not being completely on the same level. So I just said, let's go all the way. Mm.
So yes, we're talking about multiple myeloma, and intriguingly, this is something with which you have lived for a long, long time, and that in and of itself is remarkable. If I understand correctly, this is the kind of incurable blood cancer that typically claims one's life rather quickly, and so you are, in a sense, defying the odds in a extraordinary way in terms of having managed to live with this, survive this for as long as you have.
Yeah, I was diagnosed at 36, which was pretty rare, at least in that day. And the disease had just killed Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, and it was considered a complete death sentence. And it is technically classified as incurable now still. Insanely, unexpectedly, I found myself in the less than 1% of patients who managed to live 20 years with without it progressing and killing me. And I kept it secret that entire time. I think for your listeners, that's probably the most interesting thing. And people have asked me why I did that. I'll tell you. I always remember the actor Robert Urich, who played Spencer for Hire. You know, he lost a series because he was diagnosed with cancer back around that time. And, you know, we've come a long way as a country in terms of understanding the things people go through, but you don't have to go back too far to when cancer or AIDS or anything like that could lose you your career in a hurry, you know? So I kept it a complete secret and it changed every decision I ever made, Greg. I wrote more commercial books than I otherwise would have. I wrote much faster than I otherwise would have. I essentially published first drafts because I was in constant fear that the disease would switch on and kill me and that would be it. And I know that may sound overwrought, but that's the reality. Now, here's the problem. 4 years ago when I began Southern Man, I was so angry, without getting into the politics too much, but I was so angry with where the country was going at that time, that I did something I'd never done, which is after 2 years, I produced basically an unreadable draft and I threw it away and started again. And boy, that was a shock. And it was sometime around then that my disease switched on without me knowing it and nearly killed me then. So I was left with a dilemma then: either move quickly to a stem cell transplant to survive or try to finish the book. Now, 99% of the people, I think, would have chosen the transplant like a smart person. I did not. I figured I could finish the book in about 8 weeks. It took me 2 years, and I went through three extensive hospitalizations during that period, but I managed to complete it. So now I'm headed toward the stem cell transplant, but I'll be frank, it's going to be much tougher than it would have been 2 years ago.
Interesting. So that tells us something about the devotion that you felt for this particular project, and it has a whole lot to do with, it has to do with a lot more than cash advances or any of those kind of matters. It's,
I think the country is,
it's important to you for a lot of different reasons.
I think the country's in danger this year, Greg. We don't have to get too much into politics, but I think for the first time in my life, the United States of America is literally in danger in the form of government that we have taken for granted all these years. I'll say that much. And for me, I had to finish before I stopped, you know.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with writer Greg Iles about his latest book, which is a novel called Southern Man. Let's just briefly lighten the mood for a moment before we dig into the novel itself and some of its more troubling themes. One thing that is of great interest to me is the fact that you have interest in music and are a member of something I've seen called a literary musical group called the Rock Bottom Remainders. And it sounds like you have made music with some really amazing colleagues and counterparts, shall we say. Tell us more about the Rock Bottom Remainders and, in a sense, what role this group has played in both your life and your career.
It's a bigger one than you would think, or I would have thought. First of all, the members are pretty remarkable, not musicians, but certainly writers. And as top of the list is Stephen King, Scott Turow's from up around your part of the country, Amy Tan, Ridley Pearson, Mitch Albom is a keyboard player and a great singer and does a great Elvis impression. You wouldn't believe it if you haven't seen it. Myself, Roger McGuinn of the Byrds frequently plays with us. We get to play with a lot of people. But as Dave Barry from Miami, our fearless leader, says, we play music the way Metallica writes novels. Okay, it's not an artistic. And now a few of us, like Mitch and myself and Ridley, we actually were professional musicians before we were writers. But in general, we do this as a comic thing, and it has always been a charity thing. We've had different charities over the years, children's literacy and things like that, mostly. But really, we do it for the fun. I tell you, writing is an isolating profession. It can be. It is certainly for me. I'm essentially a hermit. Some of the writers in the band are more public than I, but there is nothing better than getting on a 5-day bus or airplane tour with writers that you admired your whole life and whose books you read and loved, and you can sit there and hang out and ask them anything you want about those books, and it's just the greatest. Or talk about the craft. Or now Dave, of course, would try to discourage that. He'd say, no talking about writing, only booger jokes, you know, or something like that. But in all honesty, while playing in this band, I can look back on some moments of just very quiet times hanging out with, like, Stephen King talking about novels that we were both about to work on, or with Scott Turow about the genesis of Presumed Innocent, or Amy Tan about her work. It's a phenomenal, not phenomenal, it's just a special privilege to have been part of that. But that said, it's also, there's nothing better than to be, I found myself at UCLA on the same microphone with Roger McGuinn singing 8 Miles High and Turn, Turn, Turn. And buddy, for an old musician, that is about as good a kick as you get, you know?
So my understanding is that your earliest aspirations were more of a musical type. I mean, as a singer and songwriter and guitarist and so on. But then at some point, evidently, you kind of turned away from that in order to start writing your first novel. Tell us about that shift in your sort of professional focus. And were there things earlier in your life that would have suggested that, or was that kind of a very unexpected detour with very little sort of predictive events earlier in your life, you know, indicating that that's where all of this was ultimately going to go?
You know, this interview is one of the first ones I've done. I spoke to Mitch yesterday, and then talking to you, it's reminded me what it's like to be on tour. You know, audiences, this is one of the things they're most interested in. You know, the genesis of books, how you become a writer, those kind of things. Honestly, I have pretty definite opinions about this. One, I think writing is just like music, is something you're either born to do or not. Now, I'm a decent musician, but I was never going to be Sting or Paul McCartney, okay? I can make a living, and I have made a living, but I was never going to be the best in the world. Interestingly, writing was something that I simply could always do, really essentially without even trying. It, when it came to writing, I'm not saying I'm the Paul McCartney of writing or the Sting or whatever, but for me, it's not difficult. Now, the process that I go through to write a 1,000-page novel, yeah, that's certainly difficult, will certainly wear you out. But the actual process of narrative on the page or description or the unique skills that have to do with time, I think, that are part of the gift of being a writer, those things came naturally to me. And so it was easy. The funny thing, though, Greg, is that when you're a young man, at least in Mississippi, the last person I knew of who'd written anything was William Faulkner and Eudora Welty. You know, not even Grisham had started when I did. He and I started essentially the same year. So it wasn't even a viable career. Like you, I grew up where they, you're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer or something, not something in the arts, right? So music was sort of my little rebellion. I loved doing it. There's nothing more fun. But when I got to be about 29 and was dealing with the usual, if I can say it, the usual crap of being in a band, as any musician can tell you about, I finally just said, okay, that's enough. And I gave myself 1 year to write a novel. And believe it or not, in 1 year, I wrote a novel that sold at auction and became a New York Times bestseller. And people would frequently say, well, what was the last thing you wrote before this book? And I said, my college term paper 10 years ago. And that was the truth. So, you know.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Greg Iles about his latest novel called Southern Man. And the book, among other things, takes us into the life of a character who has figured prominently in several of Greg Iles' previous works of fiction, namely Penn Cage, once a prosecutor, then an author, then a city mayor, and now in this latest book, in a sense, having moved on from quite a lot of things and significantly older and battle-scarred in a number of different ways. Take us back, Greg Iles, to the initial formation of the character of Penn Cage. And you've already touched on the fact that there are ways in which he is a reflection of you and your own life. I think it'd be interesting to hear about the ways in which you created things about him that are not reflective of you. And what kinds of things did you think about in terms of, well, it would be better if he was this rather than that? I mean, of course, the possibilities are endless when one is creating a complicated human being.
You know, that's a good question. I haven't thought too much back in a long time about the genesis of Penn as a character. You know, let me preface it with this. My father really was the absolute inspiration for Penn's father, Tom Cage, who is a lot of readers' favorite character in the series. Truly an old school physician, family physician, with a distinguished history, but and a lover of books, for God's sake. But my dad had quite a large African-American patient base in Natchez. And so he was intimately involved when the violence began in the 60s. And there were two notable bombings in our town in the late 60s. One was a guy named George Metcalf, who was an NAACP leader. And the second was named Warless Jackson. Now, the second victim, George Metcalf survived the attempt on his life. Warless Jackson did not. He was murdered in his pickup truck. Most of the truck was just shredded into scrap metal. It's terrible. And The Quiet Game, my first real book about that part of Natchez history, was based loosely on that case. But I want to drop back to the Metcalf case, because something my dad told me even as a boy stuck with me. I think he was either Metcalf's physician or he was caring for him on that day. And he went up into the hospital to check him. And George Metcalf, this African-American factory worker from Natchez, was on the phone with Robert F. Kennedy at that moment. And Kennedy was asking him about his experiences and what had happened and what he thought was about to happen in the town, et cetera. And so it really hit me then that our tiny little town could have national importance to the debate that was going on. And as I aged, I thought about that. My dad was still alive, and I got a lot more detail from him then. And so when I created Penn, I let him be the son of my own father, and that put him about halfway to being me, of course. Now, like you said, things can be arbitrary when you create a character, but I don't like to think that way. To me, rather than force something or create something arbitrarily, I would rather wait for that character to take on life on his own for me. That may sound presumptuous, and I always kind of hate it when people say, oh, at some point the characters just got up off the page and made their own decisions. You know, that sounds so corny, but all stereotypes come out of some truth, and particularly with the creation of characters, as you're asking about. Penn grew partly out of me, partly out of my father, partly out of people I admired, had come to admire in the South. Because, you know, it's easy to be brave in a place where you're not dealing with real danger and real problems. It's not when you're dealing right up with things in your face. And so, anyway, for Penn to be a prosecutor, I thought that was important. But the other thing about him is that this was a guy who started to recognize that when you confront the worst evils in this world, it takes you quickly back to Nietzsche's quote about be careful when you look into the abyss, you know, because what you find is that to defeat people who do not observe any rules and who are willing to go to any length of violence to achieve their ends, you virtually have to do that yourself. And that puts you in a very difficult position as a prosecutor or anybody who's trying to enforce the law. And that has really been the line Penn has straddled throughout the series. How far has he been willing to go to stop evil? And really, he's gone the full distance. I'll just say that, you know.
One thing that I appreciate about the way he is shaped in this particular novel is the fact that, although there's no question, but, you know, he's a good guy. He's a good man, someone that we admire for a lot of different reasons. And yet, at the same time, he is not sort of supernaturally heroic.
No.
And I think of a couple of different points in this novel in particular, and we'll get into the kind of the tension and, you know, frightening things that are occurring in the midst of all that. I mean, there are times when his daughter seems to be a more heroic, courageous figure than he is. And of course, he's an older man who's been through a lot. I mean, it's not that we fault him for that, but I appreciate the fact that this character that is to some extent closely patterned after you, you don't make him to be more of a hero than he is. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
I think some writers might be really tempted to sort of puff him up and leave him up on kind of a pedestal of greatness.
Yeah, it's tempting to do that, particularly when you're writing thrillers, which mine, as cerebral as some of my books have gotten, they do certainly remain thrillers. I don't want to completely lose the audience there. And so I give them that intensity that they want. But the temptation, like you said, is to give someone superhuman characteristics, or at least the Old West cowboy characteristics. Let me just say this. I feel like Penn has always been more of an observer than an action hero. If you think about it, a guy who's a prosecutor, he's not a cop, he's not a detective, he's not any of the traditional hero roles from a series, you know, he's not even a private detective. What he is a guy who, when he's backed into a corner or his family's threatened, he might kill you. But short of that, he's pretty restrained, and he's not going to do foolish things. Now, you brought up the daughter, and I think that's really important. And I've watched this year as Michael Connelly brought the daughter character in the Bosch series really forward. I thought that was interesting, and it's a sort of parallel with what I'm doing. And, of course, my own daughter from my first marriage is a 30-year-old attorney who's just started practicing, and she's been doing some brutal cases in Mississippi. It really scares me to death. She's living in Jackson, which is one of the most dangerous cities in the country now. But here's what I found, and you know this from your own life. With youth comes foolish bravery. You know, that's why soldiers are 18, not 48. You know, a 48-year-old isn't going to charge up a hill into a machine gun. An 18-year-old literally will. and think he can make it, you know? And so Penn Cage certainly is not that guy who is going to take foolish risks. Now, I think he will risk his life if he perceives that it's worth doing that. And I think something I want to touch on right here that a lot of people don't understand, I think. What is it that makes a hero? You know, it's not muscles. It's not Navy SEAL training. It's not all of that. Okay. The essence of heroism is sacrifice. That's what makes you tear up when you're reading that book and you see the protagonist do something that you know in your gut maybe you'd never do, but that a guy who's a true hero would do. And that's risk all for others. And that's the rarest thing. And that's the territory that I think one way or another that Penn finds himself at in almost every book, you know?
As I said earlier, this novel, Southern Man, is set very much in the immediate present day. I mean, yes. This is not set in 2015. This is set in, as we're talking, 2024. And yes. I wonder, I think that in and of itself is an interesting choice that you make as the novelist. And the fact that we see familiar names in this book, like Donald Trump and Jimmy Fallon and Trisha Yearwood and so on. I mean, you want to place this work of fiction essentially in a non-fictional landscape. And you want this to be very familiar. You are trying to set the events of this novel against a backdrop that will be very familiar and realistic, at least to a large extent. But I should think that that is tricky as a novelist. I mean, it's another thing to start completely from scratch, where you are building the backdrop as well as the foreground. I really am impressed by what you have created in this novel, Southern Man. Can you talk about that?
Thank you. Yes. I'll say this too. Boy, it's, as you say, it's not ripped from the headlines. It's literally predicting the headlines of the next 3 or 4 months. And that is a dangerous business if you don't want to look like a fool, because there's a lot of potential to be wrong, as we know, in this unstable year in which we find ourselves. Now, in terms of using those real characters, people I've mentioned, like, as you say, Karl Rove or Stuart Stevens, frequent people we see on the media at night. Some of those people I've met in the course of my career in the last 2 or 3 years, others I have not. But this is what I look at it like, Greg. If people think back to the day at time before Stephen King, Steve was one of the first people who used things like Pez and McDonald's and little pop culture references in his books that seemed odd when he first started to do that. And yet it imparted a wonderful realism to his books that had not been part of the fictional landscape. Now, those may seem like small things, but so what I think I've done here is a much larger version of that, which is take actual political figures from the present and let them be themselves on the page. I certainly didn't twist them into anything. I just let them be themselves. But I wanted to give that fabric, and I didn't want to have to dwell too much on Trump and Biden. So I wanted the realism of 2024. I wanted it clear that it was our 2024, but I didn't want to get too much into people's personal animus about this or that character. And you'll notice the Bobby White character really carries the bulk of the burden of giving opinions on the present day characters, you know, that right. We're living with.
And we should mention this really important central character, Bobby White, or Robert E. Lee White, somebody who is positioning himself to be a third party candidate for president and a very viable candidate as well. And he's viable for a really interesting sort of mixture of reasons, which are kind of amazing and yet very, very plausible.
Yes.
Tell me a little more about this man, what makes him in your novel a very likely successful third-party candidate for president.
Well, I'll tell you, Greg, this is scary. My agent just sent me a very positive review that appeared up your way today. And I was so upset because they had a huge spoiler about that character that I would have certainly rather they didn't mention. But of course, writers, we don't have any control over what people reveal about books. Bobby White is a guy who started out as a more an athlete than anything else. He went to Ole Miss as on a full baseball scholarship. But a lot like Pat Tillman, he walked away from his scholarship after 9/11 and he went overseas to fight. And there he lost his pitching arm. He comes back and he becomes an attorney. He writes a couple of histories about the South and then almost by accident becomes a radio host, a conservative radio host, which was an interesting thing for me to write as I'm fundamentally liberal, but I certainly felt like I knew Bobby White. I know a lot of guys like him. And, Bobby is one of those guys that to me is sort of a Rorschach for people who read this book. I honestly have a feeling that if a character like Bobby White were to step into the election this year at this moment, he might easily take the presidency. And I say that even with some of the darker things that Bobby reveals at the three-quarter point through the book. You know, I don't want to say too much about that. But Bobby is a guy, you know, we were talking about Penn not being an old-school hero. Bobby absolutely is an old-school hero. He's special forces in the military. He killed a very high-value target, never took credit for it. And when that comes out, it becomes part of his rapid ascent to fame and his viability as a candidate. So that's one of the exciting parts of the book, I think, for readers to see. How Bobby comes into prominence and how he exploits social media and all the modern elements of our society to quickly outpace Trump and Biden, et cetera, you know?
And what we haven't yet really talked about is that he is poised to take advantage, if you will, of a really terrifying situation that erupts near Natchez, yes. Mississippi. Involving what some people would call almost a race war, in which something really terrible occurs, and we'll just say involving some white deputies shooting some people at a public event. It's caught on video, and there are dramatic reprisals from supposedly from a black terrorist group. I mean, in direct retribution for that. And one senses this rapidly escalating, terrifying situation. And one of the things that you explore in your book is the role of fear. And that when especially a certain kind of person, which is probably most of us, feels a certain level of fear, there's no telling to whom, yes, or what they're going to turn to have those fears dealt with.
You know, Greg, I'm glad you brought that up because in the first part of your question, if people want to know what makes me different as a writer, and I think why they will enjoy these books, one of the main plot devices in this book has to do with what we call, where I grew up, the antebellum homes. What we're talking about is enormous mansions that make the Gone with the Wind mansion, Tara, look like an outhouse almost. These are the mansions that the slaveholders in Natchez, Mississippi, which prior to the Civil War had more millionaires than any city in the country other than New York. The wealth there was just phenomenal. It was unimaginable. And so those houses survived the war for a couple of reasons. And so Natchez has always been a tourist destination where people came to admire these houses. And the odd thing is that for some reason, people never sort of put it together that from the black perspective, these places are, it's like you're traveling to see Dachau or Auschwitz. These are places that were built by enslaved labor to perpetuate the cotton economy prior to the Civil War. And yet they're held up as these objects of beauty and things that should be almost worshipped. It's the strangest thing. So what starts to happen in this book as a reprisal, as you said, someone begins blowing up and burning these antebellum mansions. And in a normal thriller writer's novel, that would pretty much be the plot. It would be who's burning up the houses and how do we stop them or what do we get to the truth? in my novel, of course, I simply use that as a jumping off point to explore the complex underpinnings of those kind of things. And then, of course, what precedes that, I'll deal with this very quickly, is something we've seen so frequently in the last 4 or 5 years, which is an unintentional incident of police misconduct, but one that is particularly horrific because of the numbers involved at a concert. You know, these guys open fire on an altercation. They think they have a clear field of fire, and they ultimately kill about 20 people. And so the town within a couple of days is nearly in a state of war. And of course, the town that I live in is about 50% Black, 50% white, like a lot of parts of Mississippi. So when we say America is polarized, the part where I'm from is particularly polarized, you know? And so therefore you have the raw material for an explosive altercation at any point, you know?
And of course, your novel is not just about that explosive situation, but also the possibility of this third party political candidate.
Yes.
That needs to take advantage of that, which of course is a whole nother frightening prospect, needless to say. I also want to say, I don't know to what extent you're aware of this, but in August of 2020, there was a police shooting just a few blocks from the radio station where I'm speaking to you from. And it was a Black man, very, very seriously injured, Jacob Blake, by a white police officer. And in the wake of that were riots that were truly terrifying. And it was one of those things where you never imagined living through something like that until suddenly your own city, or even 5 miles up the road. I wanted to mention it just because I think for a lot of us, and I know at least one friend of mine who was one of those white men with a gun patrolling in his truck, trying to maintain the peace in a way that, you know, he believed the police were not. But I really think a lot of us kind of understood in that situation the power of fear and the way in which it can lead us, inspire us to do a lot of different things, including cower in our homes and not be afraid to go to the grocery store, or getting out there on the streets trying to take things into our own hands. And of course, that's a big part of what your novel is as well. How do people deal with their fear?
You know, okay, let's get to that, because I think there's two dimensions to that. One, as I've said, Penn, like me, is a liberal who owns an AR-15. Now, that may sound crazy, but I live on 40 acres out in the boonies, and I've had incidents before. And I knew I saw that the response time of the law was on the order of 40 minutes. So if you're going to be alone for 40 minutes while you're in trouble, you got to be able to protect yourself. You know, now I'm a great believer in common sense gun control, but I have realistic fear when it comes to certain type of things. Now, let's talk about fear for a second. One, the deepest fear that's occurring in this country right now, beyond question, is the demographic fear, the realization that white dominance demographically is absolutely coming to an end. And that when that happens, white privilege as we knew it will cease to exist at whatever rate of speed. The world will change. The world that you and I grew up in, where you took certain things for granted, will be gone. Certain people are okay with that. Certain people are not. It makes certain people angry. It makes certain people terrified that that change is coming. Now, concomitant with that kind of fear, which is a deep, what I'd classify racial or anthropological fear, you have sort of the fear you're talking about of school shootings, racially motivated shootings, common crime, you know, someone who'd shoot you in the head just to get your iPhone, that kind of crime as well. So simultaneously, in a lot of people, particularly people who see themselves as affluent with a lot to lose, they have these parallel streams of fear running all the time at some level, you know, the deep demographic thing and the fear of being, you know, home invasion or whatever it might be. And I think those two things, Greg, between now and November, we are likely to see some unprecedented violence in this country. I hope it's not true, but I honestly don't see how we're going to avoid it between now and November. I think depending on what happens in the Trump trials and what happens politically, and God forbid we get any more George Floyd type incidents between now and November, of course, that would act as triggers for nationwide protests. There's no telling what could happen between now and then. And I think we basically have to be ready for anything at this point.
So in terms of people reading your novel, Southern Man, what do you see, what purpose do you see your novel serving beyond entertaining us, which without a doubt it does for people who enjoy this kind of writing. I mean, it's of the absolute first rank, but I suspect that you imagine and hope that there can be even a greater purpose to people reading your novel.
Yes, I'm glad you asked me that, because, you know, we're living through a sort of a literary reckoning, if you call it that, where issues like cultural appropriation and things like that are frequently brought up. You know, do white people have the right to write from a black perspective? Do straight people have the right to write from a gay perspective? Should straight actors be allowed to play gay roles, et cetera, et cetera? All these things have come into question in the past few years we've been living through. Now, interestingly, James Lee Burke, the Louisiana writer, who's just one of the most wonderful writers in the South, just won the Edgar for best novel for a novel called Flags on the Bayou, set during the Civil War. And in that novel, he wrote from the point of view, not only of some black characters, but enslaved black characters. And I think the consensus is he did a damn good job, and he has not been canceled for doing that. And I was glad to see that, because for me, it's not an issue of simply what color you are, what your experience is, or what nominal authority you may have. It's, do you have the gifts and the understanding and the experience to write with knowledge so that the people who have lived through those things read it and go, that guy knows what he's talking about. Okay. Right. And so James Lee Burke has that. And so I, in certain places in Southern Man, I took on that burden as well. I was very careful in doing so. Now, you asked me my purpose. Let me say this. I've got nothing to teach black Americans about Jim Crow or racism or anything else. I thankfully, I have a lot of African-American readers, but I don't consider that to be my audience. Okay. I will say right up front, I'm writing, this book is written for a white audience. Now, what do I mean? What I mean is I do have a job to do with white readers, because I'm writing about a subject that a lot of white people would prefer not to think about. Think how you feel when they announce the latest incident of police misconduct where white cops shot some 12-year-old boy in some city by mistake. And think of that feeling of dread in the pit of your stomach. You don't even want to turn it on because you know it's going to be a terrible story, right? All right. That's basically the white feeling about having to think about these issues. Now, those readers are not going to read Colson Whitehead or Ta-Nehisi Coates or those black authors, but they can be seduced into reading a thriller that is intense and that gives them the feeling of, say, True Detective season one. If they read a book they love like that, they are more than willing to explore those issues of how white and black relate to each other. What is the true nature of the black experience in America and those kind of things. And so you ask me what my purpose is. Ultimately, that's really it. It's not simply to entertain. Entertaining is part of the seduction to open people's minds for me. That's it.
Beautifully put. The book is Southern Man, a novel by Greg Iles, published by William Morrill. Greg Iles, thank you so much for creating this marvelous novel and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I was really honored to speak with you, and I wish you well.
You had great questions. Thanks, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we catch up with the Kenosha Community Foundation with Amy Grile and two other special guests. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sunshine right now here in southeastern Wisconsin, but there's a 50% chance of rain developing this afternoon with the possibility of some severe thunderstorms. Today's high 79 degrees. Cloudy overnight, a 60% chance of rain, low of 65. Also a 60% chance of rain tomorrow. Again, a high of 79 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on